The day is August 6th and the year is 1945. It's the tail end of one of the bloodiest and most vile wars in human history. At some point during this day, American pilots will drop the first of two atomic weapons on the country of Japan, or more specifically, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bombings are mostly retaliatory for having been hit in Pearl Harbor some 4 years prior, but it was a decision made by the United States government to hopefully and swiftly end the war that was raging in the Pacific during World War II. Fat Man and Little Boy were the names given to these two atomic death dealers, bombs so powerful that they would be responsible for more than 130,000 deaths, with that number slowly climbing as time went on. For the rates of cancer would double in the aftermath, and thousands others would die of complications not yet known to war in the modern age. Then, after everything had settled, about 10 years later or so, Japan itself would release a short film titled Gojira, which starred a giant radioactive atomic-breathing monster that attacked Japan. When he came stateside the United States, the translation became known as Godzilla, and after that would soon become an international icon on the big screen stage. And now, almost 70 years later, with 30-plus films to his name, Godzilla is bigger and more recognizable than ever. Yet what is it about a giant mutated atomic dinosaur that remains so appealing after all these years? And what does this story have to do with so many other stories about movie monsters that we see and hear about today? I'm J.C. Alfelto, and today on The Writer's Lens, we'll be discussing my all-time favorite movie monster, Godzilla, and also discussing the monsters we make. Welcome back to The Writer's Lens. I'm your host, J.C. Alfelto, and as you might have caught from that long-winded intro, I have a lot to say about Godzilla, or Gojira, which is my favorite movie monster of all time, and you're going to find out why in this episode if you stick around. And if you do stick around, and if you're still sticking around after that long-winded intro, now is my chance or opportunity to say like, share, subscribe to the podcast, share it with some friends, start a conversation. That's primarily what I'm aiming to do with this podcast more than anything. So with that out of the way and that shameless self-promotion, let's talk about Godzilla. Now, Godzilla is my favorite movie monster for a couple of reasons. One, he's one of the first sort of sci-fi creatures that I got attached to when I was a kid. I got a movie about it when I was like 6 or 7 years old. I didn't watch the whole thing. I pretty much just fast-forwarded the VHS all the way to the ending where he shows up at the end of it. And I was in love from day one. Who or what is not to love about a massive 164-foot, 200-foot tall giant monster that can shoot fire out of his mouth and just level everything in his path? I think every young boy secretly longs to be that indestructible, or at least test himself to see if he's that indestructible. So it was not very hard for me to choose Godzilla as one of my first childhood idols, if you will. And I was even more excited to learn that there were movies that would be coming out that were newer, had better suitmation, as it's called in Japan, where an actor actually puts on a suit and then they film him fighting. For those that have never seen it, just think of Power Rangers, a very similar concept. I want to say the quality is better, but in some movies it's just not. But the earlier films, later films, I should say, it's gotten a lot better. But a little bit of history on Godzilla, just for sake of discussion. 30-plus movies, I think there's like 36 and counting. I'll get into a little bit more of that later. But they include Japan and America. Americans have been making a few films with Godzilla in the name for many years now. The first iteration of that was back in 1998. Which was a bit of a flop, if you will, mostly due to the design of the monster and the fact that he was not indestructible, but that's probably for another podcast. From a historical standpoint, Godzilla's films are viewed based upon the era that the emperor is in control in Japan. So the first round of films were known as the Showa era. The second round were known as the Heisei, I think is how you pronounce that. And then we have the Millennium and the Reiwa, which is the Reiwa era is currently what we're in now, which is, again, so all-encompassing of both American and Japanese films, but mostly the Japanese films. Godzilla's roar is pretty much recognizable among all other monsters. Again, if you're going to make a movie monster, you got to make a roar that's sort of unique and distinct. Godzilla's is. It's changed. It's altered a little bit over time. But for the most part, if you hear his roar, you know exactly who that is. His inception, how he was created, has also changed over the years. In one iteration, he's an accidental monster mutated by radioactive testing. In others, he's a guardian. He's a friend to all children, which is the version which I think I was most attached to as a kid. In others, he's an ambiguous force of nature. In other iterations, he's some sort of cursed deity, avenging the souls of fallen soldiers. And lastly, it's back to being a guardian again in the most recent versions from America. But no matter what form he's in, you know, Godzilla is often heralded as being the king of the monsters. That's kind of his claim to fame here. So there's some history about the monster, the character. And as I had mentioned before, the idea originally around Godzilla is probably the most fascinating thing about the character. And I think that's the reason why he has lasted for so long, is because his inception is so unique. The idea around him is so distinct. It's very different from other movie monsters, where in a lot of monster films, you know, people happen to stumble upon something accidentally. Maybe it's something ancient. Maybe it's something that, you know, could have been put there by aliens, or who knows what it is, and we shouldn't have been messing with it. But in Godzilla's case, Godzilla is in many ways more than just a twofold or, you know, threefold character. I mean, in one sense, he represents the bombs that went off in Japan, but he also represents sort of the agony that Japan went through. And he's almost like a swan song, but sort of a bit of mourning on the part of the people of Japan by creating this film and looking back and almost memorializing what had happened with the bombs being dropped on civilians, because it wasn't like this was a bomb dropped on an army base. It wasn't like these bombs were set off against an advancing, you know, horde of pilots in planes or anything like that, or Navy ships. I mean, these bombs were dropped in Japanese cities. And so there were people that had not been engaged with, you know, military, who had been not on the front lines. I mean, women, children were affected by this, by these bombs. And when that happens, when you get past that front line, soldiers will tell you stories, right? Soldiers will tell you stories. But when you get past that front line and a person who's not accustomed to war, who didn't sign up for it necessarily, the wounds are very, very deep. And it's even more of a wound because of the fact that when you think of any society, any civilization, and when the women and the children become martyrs, if you will, if they become part of the grievance of loss when a war is going on, it shows not just a crushing defeat on the part of the soldiers that were meant to protect them, but it just goes to show you how deeply things have now affected those people, especially if the people have to go on from that tragedy. And, you know, Godzilla certainly is just sort of a representation of this. If you don't believe me, I went and, as I have for over, you know, so many years, having watched the films and become more accustomed to Godzilla and everything about him, the original movie has several little interesting tidbits in it where the director and the producer of the film. So the director was Ishiro Honda. So he was the original director for the Godzilla film in 1954, Godzilla King of the Monsters. And he said, as you know, as quote, that Godzilla's initial rampage through Tokyo was meant to mirror the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he says, in quote, you know, if Godzilla had been a dinosaur or some other animal, he would have been killed by just one cannonball. But if he were equal to an atomic bomb, we wouldn't know what to do. So I took the characteristics of an atomic bomb and I applied them to Godzilla. Likewise, producer Tomoyuki Tanaka stated that the theme of the film from the beginning was the terror of the bomb. Mankind had created the bomb, and now nature was going to take revenge on mankind. So very, again, very interesting, almost a very tragic way of looking at this horrible thing that had happened. Again, it's part of war, but again, just a horrible... Again, I want to make sure that I am clearly articulating the fact that I'm not saying that, you know, America was wrong for doing this, okay? That's not what I'm saying. And I'm not saying that Japan was right for, you know, bombing Pearl Harbor, whatever had it happened. You know, war is war at the end of the day. I mean, there are things that are done in war that would not happen during other circumstances. And again, not condoning, you know, not saying that it's good or bad or indifferent, but war is unfortunately a part of human history. And when you go back and you look at it and you just try to say, well, that was pretty awful. There's a lot of grief that comes from that. It's just a fact of life. So Godzilla then, as I said, has been sort of this message of mourning as much as it has been a message of warning. So the producer and director there had the right idea that Godzilla was going to literally represent a living, breathing atomic bomb. And what could human beings do against that? What could we do against such a monstrosity that is now wreaking havoc upon us? It's, you know, it's not like we could really do anything. And again, this really feeds into the monsters idea that I had from this episode, this concept of how we make monsters out of sort of the violence of life, and how, you know, human beings sort of know and think of the best ways to make other people suffer. And it was, the bombs were one thing, right? The bombs were one thing, but it was the sort of the acid rain that came afterwards, and the hair that began to fall out of people that were walking around in these contaminated areas, and the diseases, the you know, the vomitous blood that would come out of people's mouths, and all these things that happened to the citizens of Japan outside of just the initial attacks, that would be a sticking point with the people. And just the fact that they were even able to do this in less than a decade after they were sort of rebuilding society in the wake of everything that had happened during World War II is really something. I mean, it really is something. But this is the part of it that I'm going to kind of pivot a bit. We're talking about monsters and the monsters we make. Because to me, this is the fundamental line in the sand between the Godzilla of the East and the Godzilla of the West. Now, as I've said before, I've seen pretty much every Godzilla film that's ever been made. I can attest to that. I am that big of a monster movie nerd that I've seen pretty much all of them. But the one thing I can say is that whenever Godzilla gets translated to the West, there's sort of this desire in Western filmmakers to turn Godzilla away from this tragic sense of who he is in Japan and make him into a guardian, make him into something we can relate to. And it's definitely become very evident with the latest Godzilla films that are part of Legendary Studios, which, again, I'm glad to see Godzilla on the big screen. His new design in Legendary is pretty cool. I liked it. But I also feel like they haven't really done the character as much justice as, say, a Japanese director or audience would do. And again, I think this just comes down to cultural differences and not understanding the real origins of the creature. Because I think a lot of people in Hollywood see Godzilla and they see dollar signs and they say, well, if we just make a movie about a giant monster beating up another monster, we'll probably make about $200 million, maybe $300 million off of it. And historically, that's been pretty accurate because people come to the movies to see Godzilla stomping on other monsters. But I will say, the thing that's frustrating to me, especially after seeing the latest trailer for Godzilla X Kong, which is, I think, like the fifth movie now in the Monsterverse of Legendary Studios, I do not have high hopes for this film. I'm just going to say it right off the bat. Godzilla and Kong, and again, for those who are uninitiated and don't know anything about movie monsters, you know, Kong is based off of King Kong, the original 1933 character that was brought from Skull Island. He's now a part of this Monsterverse where he's with Godzilla in the same universe. It was a huge, big monster movie nerd moment when it was announced that the two of them would be in the same movieverse for the first time ever outside of their 1962 meetup when King Kong fought Godzilla years and years ago, again in suits. Now it's all done in CGI, of course. But I saw the trailer and I saw Godzilla running around with Kong, and they're like buddy-buddy in this movie, and I couldn't help but feel my excitement just dropped through the floor. And I'm not trying to be a curmudgeon. I'm not trying to be this terrible critic when it comes to this kind of stuff and say, like, well, if only they would just do this. But I guess if you're going to tailor to Western audiences and say, like, this is the Godzilla that we know people are going to watch, then fine. That's great. However, in the last several years, Japan has also rejuvenated Godzilla. Toho Studios, which owns the rights to Godzilla, have made a few Godzilla remakes, sort of reimaginings of the original Godzilla film from 1954. In fact, there have been several iterations of that, mind you, where Godzilla has sort of been reinvented. 1954 was the first film. 1984, they sort of reinvented him with the new Heisei era. Then in Godzilla 2000, they did it similarly again. And most recently, they did it with Shin Godzilla. So Godzilla gets these new canonical creations every once in a while in Japan, even more so than Batman or Spider-Man in America, just to put it in perspective, I guess is the best way to put it. But the ambiance of Godzilla doesn't change in Japan. He is still this force of nature. He is this thing that is more terrifying than even the atomic bomb. He is not really relatable. He can't really be understood by human reasoning in some sense. And he can't really be corralled or controlled. And that's cool. Like that's the mystique of Godzilla. That's what makes the movie monster so interesting, is you don't know what he's going to do. You know, you have no idea if he's going to fight for humanity, if he's going to do something sort of accidentally. He's kind of a giant anti-hero, but without the logic of the anti-hero. There's not really a morality behind him necessarily, because he's kind of a giant mutated creature that defies the common natural order for all organisms. So to me, that's why Godzilla is so significant. Okay, in a nutshell, that's why Godzilla is so significant, as far as I could say. That being said, this is the thing that Western filmmakers get wrong about Godzilla, is they think that he's kind of another run-of-the-mill movie monster. You know, you can insert him into any universe, you can have him fight against another movie monster, you can have him take on somebody else, and it's all good. As long as the name is there, people will come out to see it. And I think that's true. But I'm really missing, in the American version of Godzilla, what I'm really missing is this concept of the utter despair that humans would have with a massive 350-foot, 400-foot-tall monster roaming around the world and nothing can stop him. Like, that is the part of it that I think would make for such a better story, because that's a true monster. That would be a true monster in the world of movie making and just for humanity in general, is you can't do anything about it. It's kind of like when Fat Man and Little Boy were released into the air. There was no stopping them, okay? There was no stopping these bombs. Once they were dropped and gravity took over, you couldn't stop it. There was nothing that anybody could do. They couldn't, like, deactivate it halfway down. You couldn't, you know, stop the resolve of the bomb. It literally was going to go off. You know, it was going to hit the ground, or rather it was going to explode before. I think it actually explodes before it hits the ground and just cause that giant mushroom cloud that we are familiar with, and that would be it. And that would be it. There's no stopping it. Once it begins, there's no stopping it. And to me, that really is what's missing from these Western-made Godzilla films. Most recently, there was a film in Toho, or made by Toho in Japan, called Godzilla Minus One, which, again, is another retelling of the Godzilla Inception story, where this massive organism that's radioactive comes out of the ocean, attacks Japan. In this iteration of Godzilla, it's right after the war, so Hiroshima and Nagasaki devastated by the atomic bombs, Japanese are trying to rebuild their society, and all of a sudden this monster shows up that's like, I think this version's like 50 to 60 meters tall, so he's like 164 to 175 feet tall or something like that, and unstoppable. You know, fires an atomic bomb or atomic bomb rated ray that just blows up another city. And it sends Japan from being at ground zero to minus one. And that's the reason behind the name of the film, which I think is pretty clever. I think it's a clever way of doing it. But it represents, again, the despair, the utter hopelessness of what to do in the face of something that you utterly cannot control and you can't stop once it goes into motion. And this is something, again, that as human beings, we've been sort of playing around with since the dawn of creation. You know, it's like, what can we do with nature? What can we do with this thing called the atom? Can we split it? Can we do other things with it? Can we make weapons that can slice a person in half faster? You know, all kinds of stuff. It's this sort of, how do I say this, infinite capacity of the human imagination to come up with the most terrifying things possible. And that's part of the monsters that we make. And yeah, Godzilla is a cool character as far as what it is and, you know, what he represents. I'm holding out some hope for Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire. Again, I don't think it's going to probably hit all the cylinders that I want it to for the movie. But I'm still probably going to see it, of course. And yet, I'm hopeful that there will be some of that in there with Godzilla being this unstoppable force of nature, this really cool callback to this thing that once it gets moving, you cannot stop it. And that's the truly terrifying aspect of a movie monster like Godzilla. So, not too ranty, I think, in this episode, just kind of getting my point across about how I think the East and the West really view Godzilla differently. And I will say as a sidebar, I've always wanted to write a true fan fiction series about Godzilla, so maybe I'll do that someday now that I finally got this podcast out of the way. So hope you enjoy this. I hope you enjoyed this little chat about Godzilla, my favorite movie monster of all time. If you got another movie monster you want me to kind of hack and slash up, I'd be more than happy to do so. Other than that, shameless self-promotion again. Like, share, subscribe, share with friends, start a conversation. Otherwise, you guys have a good rest of the week, and I'll catch up with you again soon. This is JC Alfalto for The Writer's Lens.